From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Detroit bankruptcy trial gets underway at last, and this may be just the beginning of a long legal journey.
And I wouldn't rule out that because this is such a different case, that in the end, it would be the Supreme Court who would want to take a close look at it.
Plus, great teachers, are they born or trained?
Really great teachers are people who learn to do great teaching. And there's no silver bullet personality trait that can determine who that's going to be.
And are women in politics covered with an unfair amount of snark?
And a lot of the reporting would be what she was wearing. Did she look tired? Did she look puffy? What was she eating?
We've got those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. We would like to think issues are what really matter in political campaigns. But when you're a female candidate, that's not always the case.
You have to start from a place where people are going to look at what you wear, what you say, how you dress, how you, you know, approach things before they even ask you how you feel about an issue that might be very important in your community.
Hello, I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why it doesn't seem like too much has changed for women in politics. And then a debate up north over smoking and the mentally ill. But first, the official name for it is the Plan Confirmation Hearing. The commonly used term, though, is Detroit's bankruptcy trial, and it began today. Stephen Henderson is the editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press. And, Stephen, we hear that word trial, and it summons the image of a criminal or civil case where someone is determined to be guilty or not guilty. But this is different, no?
It's a little different. Bankruptcy court is not like other courts, not criminal court or even civil court. But in a lot of ways, you're dealing with the same principles here, right? The city is saying this is their version of events. This is their interpretation of the solution. And those assertions will be challenged by creditors who will come in and say, well, wait a second. These solutions don't make us whole. They take too much from us, or they give too much to somebody else. And that will look very much like a trial. That will look to people very familiar who've seen courtroom proceedings before.
Stephen, the headline in the Sunday Detroit Free Press says, court battle will decide city's fate. So we know that's at stake. But truly, what do you feel is the central question that Judge Stephen Rhodes has to decide?
Well, it really has to do with the grand bargain, as we've come to call it, which brings into this bankruptcy proceeding more than $700 million from people who have nothing to do with this proceeding. So foundations, national foundations, the state of Michigan, the DIA, pensioners have all contributed to this fund that is being used to cushion the blow of the bankruptcy settlement to certain creditors, namely the pensioners, and also the DIA, which is one of the city's assets, which is being spared with this money. It is completely unprecedented in a bankruptcy proceeding for something like that to happen. And there are people who think it's horribly unfair. Some creditors think they should get the benefits of that, and why should the pensioners get that? Others think, why should the DIA not be sold? Why shouldn't we go through the collection there and put paintings out on the lawn or something and see what we get for them so you can give them more money? That really is the central question that Judge Rhodes has to deal with, is that fair? Does that hang together? Does that comport with enough of bankruptcy law to survive the likely appeals that we'll see follow this case? He's got to decide whether that works, and then whether the sort of context of that, which is handing to some creditors, you know, just dimes on the dollar for their trouble, whether that's okay, and whether that can survive appeal, and whether that's fair. And so that's what the judge is looking at really closely over the next couple of weeks.
And the idea of surviving appeal leads me to ask you, how long should we expect this trial to run? I suspect he doesn't want to step on the gas and speed anything through.
No, I think you want to give – I think he will want to give everybody with objections enough time to lay out their objections, to question city officials, the other people who worked on the grand bargain about why and how they did this. That, you know, there will also be challenges to the idea of the city's financial condition. I think some of the creditors will say, look, there's more money to be gotten here than they are bringing to the table. Why aren't you doing that? I'm guessing, and this is just a guess, I'm guessing that we're talking about at least weeks before this concludes, and maybe it's late fall, even before they wrap this up.
We're talking about the first day today, the first day of Detroit's bankruptcy trial, as we speak with Stephen Henderson, editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press. And Stephen, we've heard the most noise as far as objections from creditors coming from the companies, Cincora and FGIC, FGIC, I've heard them called as well.
Yeah.
What do we really expect them to push?
Well, I mean, I think their central premise is that it's unfair to them, right? That treating pensioners differently is not in alignment with the rules of bankruptcy court, and that giving them so little of this grand bargain money, essentially they're being locked out of that whole process. And their argument is there's a better way to reduce the city's debt, get the city money to spend on reinvestment, and protect more creditors. Now, the problem with their argument is that what they're pushing is more loans. You know, last week we saw them come up and say, well, look, we'll give you $4 billion, as much as $4 billion, to back away from this grand bargain and redistribute the payouts to creditors differently. But of course, there's some irony in going to someone who's $18 billion in debt and says they can't pay and say, well, the solution to that is another big loan. I'll loan you some more money, and that will get you out of this trouble. Of course, that's the behavior that repeated itself over and over in Detroit that got us into the situation where we owed $18 billion. So
yeah,
that's going to be where they push, is that this is unfair to them and that the city can do better if it accepts more money on a loan basis.
Stephen, are there any other parties apart from Cincora and FGIC who will be in there heavily arguing against the grand bargain, or are they going to really be the main ones?
I think they are the main outliers. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the other creditors have accepted settlement agreements, either accepted the plan of adjustment that Kevin Orr put together, or had side deals that have settled their claims. And let's not diminish, what's at stake for FGIC and Cincora. I mean, I think both of them are exposed enough in Detroit's debt that they could face insolvency if they lose as much money as Kevin Orr is proposing to take from them. And so, these are businesses, and, we think of them as banks, as sort of these faceless, soulless money grubbers.
Mm-hmm.
But, those funds hold people's pensions. They hold all kinds of investments that people care about, and regular people will be affected if Cincora and FGIC go down, as might happen because of this. So I don't want to dismiss the seriousness of their claims or the urgency with which they'll be making them.
It's not a slam dunk decision for the city or for the creditors. I mean, it's going to be a hard fought court case.
I think it is. I think if for no other reason that this is uncharted territory, this grand bargain. I mean, you just don't have anything in case law for Judge Rhodes to sort of go to say, well, this is the same thing as that, and so I can make a determination that way. He really does have to almost on the basis of first impression decide how this complies with the rules in under bankruptcy law, and that's a really complex question that I think could take him a long time to sort out. And again, the goal for him is to make a judgment and write an opinion that will withstand the scrutiny of appeal, at the appeals court level, and possibly at the Supreme Court level. I mean, I wouldn't rule out that because this is such a different case, in the end, it would be the Supreme Court who would want to take a close look at it to determine, what bankruptcy law says about all this.
I don't want to let you go without touching on what the city officials, city leaders need to bring into this courtroom. And by that, I'm wondering, what do you think it will take to convince Judge Rhodes that the city leaders are all solidly on board. They're all ready to implement this plan of adjustment once Kevin Orr's time here is done, because we know the clock is ticking on Kevin Orr.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. You've got to prove that you're ready to run things better in Detroit, that you're willing to, that you know, the hit that all of these people are taking will not be for nothing, that Detroit will be better off as a result of this. I think they've already also laid a good case for the urgency of doing something here. The tour that they took Judge Rhodes and some of the lawyers on of the city, I think, was intended to show that you know, this is a dire case, and that the people in the city are suffering because of the lack of money to provide services. I think that's a huge part of the case that you're trying to make to the judge, and they'll continue to make that over the next few weeks. The tour was just the beginning of making that argument. But you got to clear both of those hurdles for him to say, okay, this extraordinary exception that you're asking me to make, by which certain creditors will be treated better, by which a major asset will be taken essentially off the table for negotiation, you know, it's going to take at least that much convincing to get him into that space.
Bankruptcy law history being made in the courtroom of Judge Stephen Rhodes. Thanks so much to Detroit Free Press editorial page editor Stephen Henderson. Always great to talk with you, Stephen. Thank you.
Anytime.
More than a million students in Michigan headed back to school today amidst debates over education. One central question: what makes a good teacher, and how should we measure that teacher's success and effectiveness? Education writer Elizabeth Green explores these questions in her new book, Building a Better Teacher: How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you have reported about education for years, and for this book, you watched teachers in action. You looked at education programs in different colleges and universities, and I'm wondering, what do you think is a great teacher?
That's true. I've reported on education for a long time, and I thought that I knew some things about it. But I started to realize after all that observing of teachers that I hadn't understood something important, which is that I had assumed that there were just good teachers and bad teachers, and there were some secret characteristics that made good teachers good right from the get-go. But what I came to see is that really great teachers are people who learn to do great teaching. They're people who have access to opportunities to learn, and there's no silver bullet personality trait that can determine who that's going to be.
Yeah, in fact, your book really tries to shoot a torpedo broadside into that idea that a good teacher is born. What is so pernicious about this myth of the natural born teacher?
I think the issue is that we understandably look at great teachers and think about what we see, what's visible. And it seems like what's visible is some kind of charisma, a way of connecting with students. But in fact, you can be an extrovert or an introvert and you can still be a great teacher. That's not what matters. It's really much more about specialized knowledge and skill. And the problem with assuming that some teachers are just born great and some teachers aren't is that by assuming that, we fail to prepare teachers with that specialized knowledge that nobody is born knowing how to do. And as a result, we leave students vulnerable to teachers who haven't learned the basic things they need to know to help those students learn.
Why do you think this whole natural born teacher myth has become such a core belief in America? Who was pushing this?
I think that one of the reasons is that it's not so easy to figure out what does make a great teacher. And also, you know, there's not been a lot of support for the study of teaching as a craft. So both at the school level and at the university level, most of our focus is on pretty much anything but teaching, anything but pedagogy, as one of the characters in my book puts it when he talks about schools of education, that the places that are supposed to study this enterprise end up studying lots of other things, but not this core business. So we haven't spent the time really to see what's going on. Although in the last 20 years, there was a big change, a lot of it centered in Michigan, interestingly, that changed the way people think about this and is a big part of the book.
And talk about that. What was this big push and what was so important?
So there was a shift to focus research on education and turn it into research on teaching, and not just study teaching, but study the minds of teachers. And that was centered in East Lansing, Michigan, when Judy Lanier, who is the dean of the College of Education at Michigan State University, created this new institute for research on teaching, along with Lee Shulman, and the two of them together really created a revolution in the way we understand what teachers do by saying, let's study not just teachers' behaviors, but let's study their minds. And when they opened that up, they were able to see that what teaching takes is actually a special kind of knowledge. It's decisions right in the moment. You have to understand not just what the right answer to a problem is, but all the ways a student might get the wrong answer. And then a teacher in the moment has to decide how to shape a problem, shape a discussion so that the student's understanding will change. It's such sophisticated work that these two individuals, Lee Shulman and Judy Lanier, ended up deciding that there was nothing more complicated than teaching, not even being a doctor, because whereas a doctor has one patient, a teacher has 30 students, whereas a doctor has a clear beginning and end to, you know, diagnosing the problem, solving the problem. Teachers are dealing with students' minds, and that is endlessly changing. So it's extremely complicated and really, I came to think, beautiful and inspiring work.
And I'm talking with Elizabeth Green, education writer, whose new book is Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. And your book, Elizabeth, focuses a lot of positive attention also on Deborah Ball, who's dean of the University of Michigan School of Education. What is Deborah doing that you think is so right?
I think what Deborah is doing is looking at the teaching profession and saying, how can we prepare teachers better so that when they come into the job, they don't have to learn everything on the job? So she says, in other professions, we would never do this. When it comes to airline pilots or even hairdressers, we don't say, oh, you know, here's a head of hair. Please just do with it what you will, learn on the job. Or here's a plane full of 30 young minds. Just figure out how to fly it. She says teaching should be just like other professions where we invest upfront in preparing teachers for the core work they need to do. And that's what she's been doing at the University of Michigan School of Education, trying to change the way teachers are prepared. And now she's been taking that work nationally. And actually, she began as the student of Lee Shulman and Judy Lanier at Michigan State. So it's a very Michigan story.
One of the big questions in education, certainly something debated in Michigan, and it's an issue across the country, is accountability. And what's the answer if a group of students is not performing up to expectations? Who should be held accountable and in what way? And so there's a couple of ways of looking at this that you disagree with. One is this accountability. So this push to rely on student testing and on-the-job evaluations and measuring which teachers are doing a good job and which aren't, a very business-like approach. What do you see is wrong with that?
There's no question that teachers are very responsible for what students learn. When researchers look at all the factors under schools' control, a teacher has the biggest role in determining what students learn. And that's not so surprising to anyone who thinks about what's actually happening. You know, who's the person responsible? The teacher. That said, I think the question is, what should we do to help that teacher and help those students ensure that they're going to reliably get good results? And I think that, as you're saying, one of the main ideas for how to solve that problem is to hold teachers accountable for what their students learn. The idea is that by creating data to say, this teacher is good, this teacher is less good, we can figure out who should remain in the classroom and who should maybe get a reward for staying and who should be removed. But while that might be one piece of the puzzle, it's sort of the idea of, in order to teach students algebra, you should give them a bunch of algebra tests. Well, there's a role for the test, but you also have to teach them algebra in the first place. And I think what's missing in the conversation is any sense of, we need to help teachers learn to teach, because teaching is complicated and you can't just learn to do it by being pushed. You also need to be taught.
Going right back to this myth of the natural-born teacher and blowing that out of the water. And Elizabeth, on the other side of the coin, there's this argument that teachers are being micromanaged and they aren't given the freedom and the respect to just do their jobs. Tell us what you see is wrong with this autonomy argument.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the response to the big push for accountability is, you know, you're squashing our creativity. I need the freedom to do creative things with my students and let my professional decision-making rule the day. But that attitude has also really hurt teachers because it means in practice that they're left alone to learn on the job this really complicated thing. So I think there's a way to say we need to give teachers professional autonomy and we need to acknowledge that they have this responsibility, but we also can find a middle ground where teachers have freedom to figure out how to teach alongside the support they need to not have to reinvent the wheel each time they step in a classroom.
And that costs money. Money exactly. Many districts don't have. Who can do, you know, there are so many districts that are squeezing the life out of every penny they can get. So where would that support and mentoring come from?
Oh, well, I thought you were saying it costs money to leave teachers to reinvent the wheel.
Well, that
but,
too.
I mean, it's expensive either way.
Yeah.
One interesting thing is that we, you know, this makes the story a bit more complicated, but the reality is while teachers by and large report that they're not prepared from education school to learn to actually teach and on the job, they get very little support in learning what to do. We do have, you know, professional development programs that actually we spend a lot of money on. And we do have education schools that we spend a lot of money on as a country. The question is, are those opportunities actually focused on helping people learn to teach better? And unfortunately, most of the time, they're not. And teachers leave them either more confused or frustrated, but you know, we all know that those happen. We see those days off that students have because teachers are getting professional development. A big challenge that all educators face today is how to make those opportunities more successful.
And that's what I want to kind of end on, Elizabeth, what you yes. see as the challenges. What, you know, what should we yeah. all be doing as a society to teach our teachers to teach and then give them the right tools and support through their career? So first, what are the challenges to education schools in America today?
I think one of the big challenges at education schools is that there has been an undervaluing of research on teaching as well as teacher preparation. So the folks who are the most prestigious faculty members who get the biggest research grants are generally folks who are studying some other discipline applied to education, like the history of education, the sociology, economics of education, rather than studying what makes a great teacher? How can we improve teaching? You know, there was a huge push against that in Michigan, but we could do a lot more to extend that vision that began in East Lansing and take that to more universities. Another roadblock is the fact that in schools, in the K-12 schools, there is very little time to learn. So teachers in this country spend 1,000 hours or more a year with their students, leaving very little time for them to prepare to learn from each other. By contrast, countries that are much more competitive on international tests, those teachers have 600 hours a year only that they spend with students, almost half of the time that American teachers spend, leaving them with all of that extra time to learn to teach. So we need to create the structures that actually give teachers the time and the space and the content to learn how to teach.
What do you see as the challenge to policymakers, the legislative bodies that set policy for, let's talk about the state of Michigan. What's the challenge there?
Yeah, I think that the challenge is how can you legislate learning. How can you legislate learning? It's easier to legislate accountability, and it's easier to legislate autonomy, and it's easier to focus on the structures that maybe are not the most meaningful. It's harder to make the case for finding opportunities to help people learn, but there are basic structural changes that can be made and that do relate to policy. So the time in classrooms is a policy issue. The structure of the organization of teachers' work is a policy issue. The lack of, until recently, common standards to help teachers have a common thing that they can work on together in terms of figuring out how to help their students learn. You know, adding to our challenges has been historically the fact we don't have a shared curriculum or even a shared idea of what students are supposed to learn. So the Common Core can be embraced as one useful tool to help get to this place of where teachers can work together on the craft of teaching.
And finally, the challenge to teachers, to the folks who are standing in front of those classrooms in America.
I came away from reporting this book with so much more empathy, I think, and respect for what teachers do. I can't imagine going to work every day and not having the time to even do my job on top of the whole country seems to misunderstand what it is I'm doing there. And then at the same time, every year there's a new idea for how to do your job better and change everything. I think what the best teachers are able to do is somehow shut out all of that outside conversation and say, I'm committed to my work. I'm going to create out of nowhere the opportunities I need to be a professional who learns more and more every day. And we have to be so grateful for teachers for doing that, and we have to say, let's make it so that you don't have to do that against the grain. How can we make that something we support rather than something that is defying the odds?
Elizabeth Green, her new book is Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. Elizabeth, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
One of Michigan's leading quilting shows has had to cancel its October event. For some 15 years, the Keepers of Quilting Traditions show in Durand has been considered one of the best in the state, and it's a major draw for the small mid-Michigan town. Loretta Rolfs is the secretary of Keepers of Quilting Traditions. Loretta, why'd you have to cancel the October show?
Well, there's only six of us on the committee that do the show, and we've kind of struggled the last couple years getting everything done to keep it a quality show that we like. And this year, we just didn't feel like we had enough hands to get everything done that needed to be done.
And the show drew over 700 people last year, didn't it?
Oh, yes, they love it. And we love doing it. We love doing it, too, very much. So the mission of our group is to encourage and inspire all quilters.
So when you say you need more new hands, is it just a matter of you're not able to get new, younger people to join the group?
Well, we need people that have lots of energy. It does take lots of energy. We work on it pretty much year-round, and there's a lot of behind-the-scenes things that need to be done.
Have you had people expressing disappointment that the show won't be happening now?
Yes, we have.
And do you find young people interested in quilting, or is there a generation gap? You do?
No, we do. Used to be there were just older people, and there are young people interested in it, and we want to keep that interest alive.
Does it ever concern you that quilting might die out?
No. I think maybe they need to be encouraged. We need to point them in the direction. But then, too, young people, they're busy with young families, and you know, they don't have time to do any kind of craft sometimes.
Well, you're hoping then, I guess, that it get a few more hands on board to help out and be able to do the show next year.
Absolutely.
Loretta Rolfs is with the Keepers of Quilting Traditions group in Durand. They've had to cancel their 15th annual show in Durand because they just did not have enough helpers to pull it all together. Loretta, we'll hope you'll be able to do it next year. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
We welcome your comments, your opinions, your suggestions. You can find us on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, we're at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside.